Today's talk is given by Dr. Humphrey Saddle of the University of Portsmouth. His talk is entitled Past Place, Rethinking Gazetteers for the Semantic Web. Dr. Saddle originally graduated from the University of Cambridge, then spent a year as a special student at Harvard University. He returned to Cambridge to study for his PhD, then became a lecturer at Queen Mary University of London. He was promoted to Readership at Queen Mary in 1995 and moved from Queen Mary to Portsmouth in 2000. Since then, he has been one of the leading names in historical GIS and has been a driving horse behind several significant projects such as the Great Britain Historical GIS and the later Division of Britain website, as well as things such as Old Maps Online and, of course, now Passplace. And with all the hype and buzz around big data these days, it's easy to overlook the fact that there's whole libraries of historical data out there that can provide much useful information, much useful analysis can be done. It's also possible to overlook the fact that perhaps some of the recent developments in web-based delivery of GIS have been related to historical data, and that some of the greatest innovation perhaps has taken place while looking at what we can learn from the past. So therefore, we look forward to a very interesting and also quite timely seminar.
Okay. I should begin by saying that when I proposed this seminar title about 6 months ago, I thought I was going to be writing a rather general think piece. The actual context is rather different. I've just sent an email to a programmer who's about to leave me after 10 years in 25 minutes' time, asking, can he fix a bug? So there's going to be rather less conceptual stuff here. And I'm going to spend quite a lot of my time describing the extremely improbable mating between Vision of Britain and Wikipedia that we've been carrying out over the last couple of months. I also add that this is, I mean, you may end up deciding this isn't really about geographical information at all. So what am I going to be doing? First, I'm going to say a bit about historical gazetteers in general. I'm then going to briefly survey existing global gazetteers, not historical. And I'm then going to be talking about the Past Place project. And quite a lot of that is really going to be a discussion of two projects that we're drawing on, one of which is the Wikidata project, the other is the Plagios 3 project. And I should emphasise I'm not actually one of the principals in either of those projects, although I'm a member of the Plagios 3 project. And that's going to be reasonably well organised. I think this last bit, which is about what we're doing specifically for Past Place, it's going to be rather visible. It's a work in progress. But I think you'll get a sense of what we're doing. And I'm going to end up with, that's really about one slide, but it's what I'll be leaving you with, making some really quite strong assertions about why the whole geospatial approach is wrong. is arguing instead for a geosemantic. Okay, and in a way that's what we're starting with as well. That history isn't really about maps. What we have in history is mostly text. And that's particularly true if one goes back to the... if you go back before the 18th century, there are really not a lot of maps. You'll discover that later on that we're concerned with just about everything you could possibly describe as a map from before 1500. Incidentally, if you think of me as somebody who works on 19th and 20th century Britain, you're going to be a bit confused. This presentation is not about 19th and 20th century, and it's certainly not about Britain. And by and large, historical, geographical information before the 18th century consists primarily of text. And it's geographical because it contains place names. And the most geographical texts are really either itineraries, descriptions of journeys of varying degrees of formality, or gazetteers. It should also be, I think this is a really quite important point, that if you haven't got modern surveying equipment, in a certain sense, every map you can possibly produce is simply wrong. So that's the people who really offend by that artist, over to cartographic historians. It's a valid cultural artefact, yes, of course it is. But as a record of this sort of geometry, it's going to be wrong. On the other hand, a textual description, even going a long way back, can be an entirely accurate statement. A description of a journey, for example. It may be quite limited, but what it says can be entirely true. And of course, on the other hand, you've got maps that look like this, the map of Mundi in Hereford Cathedral. And, I mean, the Plagius 3 project, among other things, is working with the map of Mundi. So there's clearly an issue of what exactly do you do with something like that. You certainly don't exactly digitise the conventional way. So we're concerned with textual bodies of information, not with maps. And we're concerned with gazetteers. Briefly, in a sense, gazetteers are well defined. There's an international standard, ISO standard, this thing. An interesting point about that definition, if you read it carefully, you discover it does not in fact require a coordinate reference. If it contains a coordinate reference, but it can be simply relating one set of geographical labels to a different set of geographical labels. That said, most practical work on gazetteers has tended to reference these more detailed standards. The OGC Gazetteer Service Protocol, also known as WFSG, which is very much a way, it's a way of accessing a web feature server. It's very much a way of accessing stylized GIS content, but on the assumption there are some names in there somewhere. And I do think that's, in a sense, typical of the way that mainstream GIS has tended to think about gazetteers. A rather richer standard is the ADR Gazetteer Content Standard. And in fact, even though it has far less formal support, in practice, rather more has been done with that standard. But, I mean, my problem with the ADL standard is that potentially it describes a very rich gazetteer, but most ADL compatible gazetteers just contain four things. Unique identifier, a geographical name, a coordinate, and a feature type. I.e. what kind of thing it is. I have a massive problem with feature typing, which I don't probably want to bore you with that much of. Anyway, I'm certainly arguing that for historical work, and maybe for certain other purposes, we need something rather different from what those standards define. What is a historical gazetteer for? It needs to be able to enable us to link together references to broadly the same place, and there's definitely an issue of what exactly makes two places one and the same. It's not necessarily simply coordinates being very similar. But it enables us to link together information. It must link to toponyms appearing in a wide range of geographical text. But in a historical gazetteer, we don't just want to know that things have a lot of different names. We want to know the specific context that those names come from. It must allow for the uncertainties of our geographical knowledge of the past. In historical contexts, we often have to deal with places where we're not really sure where they are. One example of that is almost mythical places, possibly entirely mythical places, Avalon and Camelot. Pretty much everyone who's heard of those names at all recognises that they're the names of places in Britain. But what are they beyond that? But also, that's a reference to the fact that the I think it's now the Clwyd Archive Service has a list of about 30 townships which existed in Denbighshire in the Middle Ages, and beyond that nobody knows where they are. They're not as exciting as Avalon and Camelot, but if you're concerned with certain kinds of history, this lack of certainty about where they are is just as much a problem. And lastly, a lot of the reasons why people want a historical gazetteer is not to find out where places are or were, but what they were like. Certainly, an awful lot of people using Vision of Britain are family historians who are trying to find out the kind of place their ancestors came from, not simply where they were. That, of course, takes you in. I mean, potentially a gazetteer becomes quite vast. It's a body of information that tells you what places were like. part of the context of the work I'm talking about, is the CHEA project. CHEA is a three-year project funded by the US National Science Foundation, linking five US universities. I'm involved in it partly because I actually, well, for example, went to Pittsburgh and made a pitch to an NSF administrator, but also more recently because of HRC funding under their big data program for a project that's pretty much about me operating as a component of the CHEA project. What's CHEA trying to do? It's basically trying to build a statistical database not through advertising for data from the general public, really, but trying to recruit academics who've done some research, have got some relatively small data set they've built up, and they want to contribute to this larger system. And there are a whole bunch of issues about how, I mean, creating a system where people can upload individual data sets so that other people can then download the same separate data sets is not that big a problem. But the issue is, how do you fuse together the different data sets contributed in this way so that you've got a single coherent body of information that your analyses can be done on? And obviously, quite a lot of the problem is how to capture the geography in those different data sets. And note we're talking about the whole world, and we're going back four centuries in CHEA. And I think one of the things I keep emphasising in some of the discussions within CHEA is we cannot assume that the historians who've gathered the data really understand the geography the data relate to. Some of them just want to link data, statistical data, to vaguely defined lists of populated places, which is very unlikely to be appropriate. As we go back before 1815, there are real issues about political geography being quite confused. In the work we've done today, if you're wondering why 1815, it's the date of the Congress of Vienna. After the Congress of Vienna, all sorts of things were fairly well defined. Before that, tricky. And, I mean, if you're talking about Africa, and I mean, the director of the CHEA project, Pat Manning, is an Africanist, immense issues about what political entities existed in inland Africa before colonisation. And ultimately, there are always going to be problems dealing with sovereign states, because ultimately they define themselves. At the moment, I've actually been doing rather detailed work with a shapefile produced by the US State Department called the Large Scale International Boundary Dataset. And there are some quite murky things in a data set describing the situation in March 2013. And, I mean, you know, what are they doing about Crimea at the moment, sort of thing. But I'll give you a simple example. Nothing to do with Africa or strange parts of the world. Simply part of England. I don't think there's anything quite as bad as this in Scotland. But those are the red line and the purple line are definitions of Cambridgeshire, both of which are used by the 1911 census. Both called Cambridgeshire, both legally defined in a clear formal sense. And frankly, most demographic historians are totally confused about this. And they tend to just assume the same thing. And note that modern Cambridgeshire is all of that. I must get this thing modified so it includes modern Cambridgeshire as well. But immense confusion about historic roots not that long ago, and certainly not all that far away. Can I postpone for a lot?
4 hours.
4 hours. I'd also add, just as one final point, is at the moment we're preparing a proposal as part of the European Union in Luxembourg who want a detailed GIS map of wards within 1961 British cities. That turned out to be quite murky. And what worries me, because in the CHEA context, where all the work's been done by computer scientists who are trying to build an entirely inductive system, is that if the historians doing research are confused about the geography, you can end up with a total mess. And I personally think we need to build a gazetteer not simply by deriving it from the statistical data sets as they're contributed. Now, having made an argument, we can't just use gazetteers as they're generally defined by people like the OGCB in something different. I would still argue that we can't start from scratch. It's far too large a task. We have to start with some existing modern gazetteer and build on that. So the next part of the discussion is simply, well, what should we be using? We need something that people are going to find useful and it is actually something that covers the world from day one. And that was the real question confronting a group of us, all members of the Pelagius Project, in a meeting we had last September. We had to just pick a modern gazetteer to use as the foundations for building a historical gazetteer. And there were some obvious requirements. It needs to be global in scope. It needs to avoid copyright issues. It needs to list the right kind of thing. Now, in fact, that last point, well, clearly that's the thing that's not immediately obvious. But I would argue, and I think broadly speaking, people at that meeting took broadly this line, that there's a problem, that there are really three quite fundamentally different kinds of things that gazetteers cover. And the data standards tend to be referring to gazetteers of geographical features. Geographical features are what mapping agencies are fundamentally concerned with. They're things that exist in the landscape that you can go out and touch. But historically, geographical features can be quite ephemeral. They don't actually last through the centuries. They also pose this issue of how do you classify them? You have to impose a classification on them. You have to develop a feature type classification. By and large, you develop a classification based on the symbologies on topographic maps, which is certainly what the ADL Gazetteer feature type thesaurus is based on. However, we're also concerned with administrative units. And in fact, historically, we're far more concerned with administrative units than we are with geographical features. And they're different. They don't exist physically in the landscape at all, the boundaries of administrative units. They may follow landmarks, but the boundaries themselves don't exist in the landscape. They exist ultimately in legal documents. And the creation, abolition, naming and typing, and definition of boundaries are all the results of legal processes. One fundamental point is if you're trying to build historical gazetteers of administrative units, you should not be trying to squeeze them into a classification of first order, second order, third order, and fourth order subdivisions. You should find out what they actually legally are and record that. And then there are places. Places are different again. Places exist ultimately in people's heads and in the conversations between people, and to some extent in written communications between people. They don't exist in the landscape, they're not legally defined. I think if you're trying to define what places exist today, crowdsourcing, I mean there's some lovely stuff about the names used to tag, place names used in Flickr to tag photographs by location. That really is an excellent way of finding out what places exist today. But there are problems if you don't think about these three different things as being somewhat distinct. Anyway, this is our overall list. Things we might want to talk about. Although this is the long list. Google Maps, no, can't use it. It may be sort of very widely usable, but it's not actually open data, it belongs to Google. The US Board on Geographic Names and NGA Gazetteers, freely usable, downloadable, but they don't actually exist as directly addressable resources on the web, and that was actually another of our requirements. In practice, if you use those, you mainly use GeoNames. You'll see GeoNames is not on this list. Ordnance Survey linked open data, in many ways great, but only covers Great Britain. OpenStreetMap, a massive body of data, looked at semantically. OpenStreetMap comprises 20 billion triples, which is really rather a lot of stuff, but rather large issues about name attributions. I'll skip over OpenPOI. DBpedia, if you've not heard of it, is a widely known linked data version, more formalised version of Wikipedia. The problem with DBpedia Wikimedia project, it has to take Wikipedia as it stands, and there are various issues that need to be sorted out in Wikipedia. Shortlist consisted of two, geonames and Wikidata. Geonames was the obvious answer in many ways. Global, freely downloadable, widely used, but it does have some substantial problems. The biggest problem is that, in fact, in our terms, a lot of places are in there multiple times, and things get quite confused. A lot of my knowledge is specifically about English villages. English villages are mostly in twice, but it's a bit arbitrary which ones are in twice and which are in only once. If they're in twice, it's because they appear both as a populated place and as either a third or a fourth order administrative subdivision. And which of them they are depends entirely on whether they're in a district, which is itself within a county, or if they're in a unitary authority. And to a historian who's not interested in that, they're parishes, really. And it's nonsense to say they're third or fourth order, depending on this particular, rather specific, modern issue. Also, geonames is really quite poor on places within towns. But another issue is we simply couldn't see a way that... The only way we could use geonames, because we would have to filter it very heavily. We couldn't feed what we'd created back into geonames. And we wanted something we would continue to interact with the modern resource, not merely create our own clone of it and develop it separately from there. Lastly, geonames as a project, as a resource, depends rather heavily on a particular individual. It's not the creation of a company or a big international organisation. It's basically the creation of a guy in Switzerland called Mark Wick. So, the other possibility was Wikidata. How many people here have heard of Wikidata at all? Okay, that's interesting. What was I expecting? Wikidata is a fairly new project of the Wikimedia Foundation. The Wikimedia Foundation is the organisation behind Wikipedia. And Wikidata exists primarily to enable closer integration between the different language editions of Wikipedia. That at the moment, or before they started, Wikipedia consisted of lots of separate language editions which tried to write about the same entities in the different editions and contained cross-links between individual articles. The only thing is that that shows six different editions and there are 187. Doesn't really work. So what they're trying to do with Wikidata is to create a hub like that where all the different language editions refer to the same language-neutral hub which defines these entities in a formal sense and enables the whole structure to be more closely integrated and also enables new kinds of fact-checking. Broadly speaking, if anything has an article about it in any of the language editions of Wikipedia, it ends up with a Wikidata ID. A Wikidata ID is a number, not a name. To me, that's a major virtue over DBpedia, because the actual names on Wikipedia articles are often quite problematic. And Wikidata entities have properties. One of the problems we have to live with, having gone down the course of using Wikidata, our gazetteer can only hold things which have a Wikipedia article about them. I'm now going to go into a brief aside about when we do actually have some capacity, when I don't regard the contents of Wikipedia as wholly fixed. I'm currently running an undergraduate course called Applied Human Geography at the University of Portsmouth. This is the course page for that course within Wikipedia itself. And in fact, if you click on that View Activity button up there, you can see in real time what each of the individual students on my course are doing in editing Wikipedia. This is the ultimate surveillance. Total oversight of student activity. But here's one of the articles the student... This is an article before we worked on it. It's for somewhere called Sawley in North Yorkshire. I mean, we worked on it because there wasn't much there. It's a parish, right? And, they all get an article, and they really do edit the actual Wikipedia articles. It's not some sort of thing that looks very like Wikipedia. They do get a bit freaked out by that, because they're first years, and it's a bit stressful. And that's the article after the student finished on it. You can see we've, for example, added quite a lot of population statistics to it. And then that's the article, that's the page for the same village in Wikidata. As you can see, the information is much more formal. It's an instance of a general kind of thing called village. It has a coordinate. It's part of England. This one actually fails to record the fact it's formally that's in Yorkshire, I think. And down below, you find information about the different Wikipedia articles. In this case, there aren't many articles, other than in the English language version of Wikidata. But just to get across the fact that Wikidata is overall a major geographical resource, this is a visualisation. It's nothing to do with us. If you go to that URL, you'll find a lot of stuff. It's interesting. When you run this, basically 25 megabytes of data downloads into your browser, and it then generates the map using JavaScript within the browser. All sorts of interesting interaction becomes possible. But this gives you some idea of the geographical scope. Not just of English language Wikipedia, but the whole thing. Dense in the United States, you'd expect dense in Europe, also dense in China. Problems in Africa, clearly. And then, I think I'd better skip over this, but one key point about Wikidata, and Wikipedia more generally, is that while in geonames, if a thing is multiple things really, it ends up as multiple entries in geonames. In Wikipedia, it ends up as a single thing with multiple properties. And that much more closely fits the way that I and the other, basically historical researchers in the Plagius project view things, and that is the central reason why we're basing our work on Wikidata. And Wikidata is under Creative Commons licensing. There are interfaces. There are also problems that it's pretty new. And at the moment, the current Pars Plagia Gazetteer, that I'm going to briefly show you at the end, has quite a few problems because of limitations of the Wikidata dump, that's why I'm going to Berlin to talk to the Wikidata team at the end of this month and hope we can resolve those issues. But certainly this wasn't, it would have been less risky to use geonames. Okay, that's Wikidata. Next, the Plagius 3 project. It's a two-year project funded by the Mellon Foundation. It is led by Leif Isaacson of Southampton University, and it builds on Plagius 1 and 2, which were very much to do with the world of the Greeks and the Romans, the classical world, and working with the Pleiades Gazetteer, developed by New York University, which is why we met there in September. And there's a whole bunch of other partners, including Kate Byrne at the University of Edinburgh. What's Plagius about? It's in that Guardian article, was wonderfully misleading. It talks about it as if the project was finishing, when in fact it was announced as it started. Plagius is about early geospatial documents, or EGDs. What's an EGD? Well, it's certainly a map, but it's also things that are a bit like maps, and it's also things that aren't maps at all because they consist entirely of words. So itineraries, gazetteers, travel writing. The definition of early is quite precise, before 1492. Saying you're limiting yourself to maps produced before 1492 cuts your workload down rather dramatically. There were an awful lot of maps produced shortly after 1492. You'll realise, for example, there are no maps from America at all within the scope of the Plagius project. And it's also about developing a model for annotations. This is not really about building gazetteers from scratch. It's rather about finding instances of the places in an existing gazetteer in older sources and linking together all those references. And it's about, in other words, generating annotations. In a certain sense, about the names table, the variant names table in GeoNames. And had Mark Wick taken a different line on how the variant names table should develop, we'd probably be using GeoNames despite other issues with it. But the crucial thing is that this format enables to identify very precisely not simply a date in the past that the name is somehow associated with, but a specific historical document the name appears in, including, among other things, the date when the document was produced. The idea that names have dates independent of particular documents they appear in is just wrong. Plagiosaying is to create a gazetteer ecosystem, and I don't have time to talk through all of this, but it'll become clear that I don't entirely agree with the Plagios project, because I'm actually trying to build one big gazetteer which contains as much material as possible. But we're certainly part of Plagios. And the three gazetteers currently in Plagios are firstly the Pleiades gazetteer already mentioned, secondly the China Historical GS at Harvard, and thirdly Past Place, which in a certain sense is a rebranding of Vision of Britain, but greatly extended in scope. And it's also about collections of historical sources. There are six content work packages in Plagios, two concerned with the Romans and Greeks, which are about enhancing the Pleiades Gazetteer, one to do with early China, obviously going to the Harvard Gazetteer, and three going into the Past Place system. Briefly, those three work packages are the early Christian tradition, that is, of course, the Mappamundi again, and these are some of the sources. Secondly, the early maritime tradition. This is mainly work to be done by Tony Campbell, who used to run the British Library Map Library, is now retired, but still rather actively retired, and he's going over all these old navigational charts from the Middle Ages, extracting the names that appear. And thirdly, the early Islamic tradition. So, we don't exactly have to expand our system to cover the world, we certainly have to make it expand to cover the Arab world for Plagios, and again, some of the specific sources. So, I've gone fairly briskly through a bunch of sources, well, two other projects, and made reference to the fact we're in some sense drawing on them. I now want to say a bit about Past Place itself, and this is going to be a little bit less formal. Firstly, the funding directly for Past Place is very patchy. We don't have a big grant. I have a major practical problem that, in my opinion, the HRC funded the wrong project. That what we have the money for is not a bad project, but it isn't really. And I think most people involved in the CHEA project would agree with that statement as well. The main thing most want from me is actually the gazetteer, not the work I'm supposed to be doing for the HRC grant. And in fact, quite a lot of the money going into Past Place, this may sound bizarre, is coming either from my project's existing commercial earnings, which were £45,000 last year, or they're coming from a HIFE grant. If you're an academic, you may have heard of HIFE. It stands for the Higher Education Initiatives Fund, and it's for pump-priming commercial projects. And I've somehow got this money to do a load of work on a 19th century gazetteer. This gets a bit surreal at times. Anyway, what are we ourselves doing? Firstly, that 19th century gazetteer. This is the front page of the first of the seven volumes of a book published in Edinburgh called The Gazetteer of the World or Dictionary of Geographical Knowledge. We've calculated it contains in total 5,913 pages, an extremely small print. It contains around 87,000 entries, about 7.3 million words. It's all been scanned and roughly OCR'd by Google. We've extracted all of that OCR text from Google Books, which is a little bit fiddly, and we're currently paying a bunch of students to clean it up. So That's a very small part of one of the pages, as it appears in the original images, and that's the cleaned up text. And all of this is being linked into our system. And will mean that we start to tell people not just where places were, but what they were like. Secondly, we're building a web map server. We've already built one for Britain and, in fact, for Europe. We're building a new one for Fast Place based on 1 to 1 million maps of the world. It's not all that exciting. The maps are mostly from the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. They're produced by most of the British and American military. But it does mean we will have a system where the base maps are visibly historical artifacts, just about, not simply Google maps. And a lot of those maps are coming from the University of Texas, and they're really scanned. We've also got a data model. I certainly don't have time to go through it. This is about Vision of Britain. There is quite a lot published about this. A series of three articles in the Journal of Historical Methods. But behind Vision of Britain is something very different from conventional GIS, with a great many relationships. That's the result of running visualization, ontology visualization software on part of the Vision of Britain data structure. That's Estonia as a concept. These are all the empires that Estonia has been part of over time. Higher levels of there called Scandinavia, something called the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, which Estonia was part of until 1561. No, there's no coordinates. We don't necessarily know much about the geography of this at all. We just know that these relationships existed at certain places. And we also have not just a deep data model, but also a notion of how this should be presented to the general public. And crucially, it's about creating place pages. This is the Vision of Britain place page for Portsmouth. And we bring together here an excerpt from an old map, a location map which tells you where it is in the world, and a descriptive gazetteer. If you go into Public Vision of Britain, you'll find there's much more deeper information, like statistics. What we're trying to do with Past Place, for now at least, is just do the most superficial stuff. A bit of an old map showing the place, a general location map showing where it is in the world, and some descriptive text, obviously taken from the gazetteer of the world. Finally, I hope I'm about on time. This is the bit that's really quite dodgy, but we have spent the last 2 months writing the first version, really, of three bits of software which access the data, expose it to the world. And that is not direct, whereas Vision of Britain is a fairly conventional, there's sitting underneath it is a relational database, and we have a website running directly on top of it. The web page is generated on the server by Java server pages mostly, containing direct calls into the database. With PassPlace, we're trying to do something a bit different. And very much interfacing with the semantic web broadly defined. And I haven't said much about the semantic web. What I'm going to talk about now is not that in theory, but the bits of software we've been developing. And firstly, at this point I'll try to switch to some other things that maybe make things a little bit clearer. Sorry, I'm not. Is that, I don't know how really legible that is, I'm not sure if I can make it any bigger. We've been writing a program which generates a dump, and that's the beginning of the dump. The full dump is a single 180 megabyte text file, and that's with a very small version of Past Place. Once we've sorted out the problems with Wikidata, it's clearly only 10 times bigger. But it's broadly speaking the whole thing, as a single text file, that you can download and put onto your own system and broadly speaking do what you want with. The format here is called Turtle, which is a compact representation of IDF, which is the standard language of the semantic web. One of our problems, I'm a bit frightened by this header, because that basically says we're referencing 14 different namespaces in defining this thing. You don't want to invent stuff yourself, you want to try to use things that are already being defined. But it turned out, in particular, to really thoroughly provide citations, not just provide the information, but provide evidence where it came from, which is what's so lacking in much of this stuff. We had to borrow from an awful lot of different places. And the next part of the header is a list of our references. So the first one is, in fact, a reference to a book by a man called William Adams, called Memoirs of a Social Atom, published by Hutchinson's of London in 1903. And the point is, we've taken place names from that book, so we need to provide citations to it as part of the dump. The next one is farming statistics, if I start going down, Bartholomew Gazetteer of the British Isles, 1887, Boundary Commission of Scotland, 2005. So we're citing the sources for basically everything. That was Boswell's Tour of the Hebrides just flashed past. Then if we go on down, we start finding the actual place records. I don't have time to go through them, but basically this is information about places. There are two things I will emphasise, though. One is that line there says DC Terms License, and it then cites Creative Commons Commercial Commons License BY, which means Nothing Acknowledged 3.0. So that's machine-readable information saying this is information that can be fairly freely used as long as you acknowledge it. One of the points I made is the first version, this is a format specified by the Gladius Project, the first version said we should use this license. There was no mechanism for actually containing acknowledgements. This format, we figured out how to include just about everything. I don't have time to go through it, but you'll find it also contains a lot of references to somebody called David Gatley, not as a publisher, but as a contributor, because David has given us a lot of information. He transcribed the 1831 census parish table. We've drawn on it, so we reference him by name, deep within the dump. So that's the dump system. Secondly, we've been developing an API.
Can I just ask a question? How do you attribute books?
Well, that's up at that's what I was showing you at the beginning.
Yes, but how do you relate those to the place records?
Down here it says DC term source EB. And that EB was the thing to find up there. I think one of the issues is this is the first time we've exposed this stuff, and some of our abbreviations probably benefit being slightly longer, so you didn't need to see the DEFCON credit. I don't know what EB stands for in that case. The API enables you to query the thing. It's a program, the dump system is just a little run, creates a file, you can go and download. It's a rather big file, as I said. The API means you can send a query to us and we will send you information back in a variety of formats. And to explain what the API does, the best thing I can do is talk quickly about the third piece of software we've been writing, which is that. The reason I've got it in a separate web browser is because that web browser has obviously been made extremely small. Because this is in fact something which works okay on a mobile phone. And that was a major goal. It's not a mobile phone app. It's a web. It's a lump of JavaScript designed to work with a web browser. But it has been designed to work on touch devices and on small screens. It uses jQuery Mobile as a basic framework, and it uses OpenLayers. Although I think actually that version uses Leaflet, but one of the versions uses OpenLayers, because the newer versions of OpenLayers actually do work okay on touch devices. And it's actually quite elegant. It's quite nice to play with this thing on a tablet. We don't have the resources to develop lots of different interfaces, but we can develop a single interface that will work on a computer, on a tablet. But what does this thing do? It doesn't talk directly to our database. It talks to the API. It sends queries to the API. That talks to the database. And when talking to this, the API sends the information back in JSON, which is a format which the app knows how to make sense of and lay out. So that, broadly speaking, there's a phrase in this stuff which is eating your own dog food. If you're developing an API for other people to use, you ought to use it yourself to make it work. So a long reason for developing the app is to test the API and ensure it does provide enough functionality to do something useful. Okay, I'm aware I'm running out of time, so I will now return finally to the PowerPoint. And I sort of covered these slides by going to those other files. That's the API, that's the app. Final statements. I said at the beginning I would be rude about the whole of geospatial methodologies. But one rather basic obvious point is that ultimately there's a clear sense in which geosemantic representations of information are tend to be inferior to geospatial ones. Because if you have a map, you can derive statements like B is in A, C is near B, clearly, from the map. But if you've got statements like those, you cannot derive a map from them. So, clearly, you're downgrading the information. But there are important limitations to that. Firstly, historically, in the past, all we may know is that A is in B. At the moment, that's actually all we know clearly about the wards of Birmingham in 1961, which is a bit worrying. There's a solution to that, but what we definitely, as a project now at the moment, is simply that these wards were in Birmingham, don't know where they were. And as I said also, even if old maps exist, they're likely to be so inaccurate you can't rely on them. Whereas certain kinds of textual statements you can rely on. Secondly, if you're working in the web, there are, of course, a lot of geospatial websites, but the web as a whole is not a spatial structure, it is a semantic structure. It consists of named entities, web pages, linked by relationships, hyperlinks. And this kind of structure works remarkably well with the web, far better than conventional geoestrogram websites. Why have we been able to get money from the university under a commercial pub priming scheme for building, well, get paying a load of undergraduates to sort out an 1850s gazetteer? The reason is we've managed to build a website which, for places in Britain, if you type place names into Google, put some indication you're interested in history, most of the time our website will appear in the first five hits on the first page of matches in Google. That is a formula for getting on traffic, and if you stick advertising on the website, you will make money. Last year we made £20,000 from Google Ads, basically. And that's on a purely British site. Build a global site based on the same formula, you might be making serious money. That's the logic, but that's getting quite annoying. And I could say quite a lot more about that. I mean, I'm always surprised how uninterested most people in the public sector are in how their websites perform in Google. Most of them are appalling. And it was actually quite easy to improve them a great deal. Nobody actually seems even interested. If you're trying to provide information to the public, you should make the information accessible to the public. And the way most people access data is through search engines. And overwhelmingly, that means Google, have about 90% of the market in Britain. Thirdly, if you're working with people, I don't have time to talk a lot about this, but basically people don't think in terms of maps. I belong to a walking club. Most of the members are confused by maps. They want to read textual instructions. I actually disagree with them. I think you get lost if you try to follow walks just from textual instruction. But that's what they do, it's what they're comfortable with. These days, lots of people, they don't use maps, they have a sat-nav. The sat-nav tells them where to go. People, actually, by and large, people who like maps are a small and weird minority. I also add that, I mean, we've got plenty of coordinate data in these systems. We're not injecting it all entirely. The final point actually is not on that list. If you care about computational efficiency, these kinds of data structures work very, very well with relational databases. It's all very fast. Whenever we hit the spatial queries, things tend to slow down. And that's quite one of the significant factors itself. I'll probably flip back to that slide when I've completely stopped. Just a couple of acknowledgements. Quite a lot of what you've seen, the stuff about Wikidata, a lot of that was really the work of Andrew Gray, who a year or so ago was the AHRC-funded Wikipedian in residence at the British Library, though he now works at the British Antarctic Survey as a librarian. And a lot of the material about Pelagius III really comes from the three principles of that project, Leif, Upton and Rainer. And Rainer has played it with, although Rainer's sitting in Vienna, he and I have been working rather closely together the last couple of months. And finally, those are the two old addresses. Past place, there's not much there at the moment. We need to link in some more stuff. But the things I've shown you are not quite ready. I mean, a lot of them were written this week, so not quite ready for prime time. And the Pelagius project, they've got a blog, basically. So if you want to read more about Pelagius, it's there. www.wikidata.org is too obvious that you are up. Okay, that's it. And I'll flip back to those comments about the geosemantic versus geospatial, which I suppose originally I was supposed to say more about. Is that okay? I've spent a bit too long.
Yeah, right. Thank you. Straight in the board.
What if you can't derive an actual, for example, if you look at old texts, what if you can't really derive a year of origin, or what if it's written in a year that it's not talking about?
One of the things our system does is distinguish between publication dates and attestation dates. And the attestation date is our attempt to identify the year when the name is actually used to refer to something. That can be a bit tricky. There is also, at the moment, the way the system works is there's actually another column called attestation date string that we can shove anything into, and that is what is used for display, if it's got something here. Although, for now, we are saying there's got to be a year in there as the attestation date. In practice, for most of our own materials for Britain and England, I mean, we do know pretty precise dates. Some of the Pelagius material, where it's sort of inscriptions and archaeological remains, then certainly you've got a greater degree of vagueness.
And if your maps are classified, for example, botany, what if they, because navigational systems at the time, most maps were recently discovered. Some maps were placed in a long time because some techniques of navigation were not known.
Okay, on that, all I can say is that the person doing that work and putting the dates in is Tony Campbell. He's supposed to be a global authority on medieval navigation charts. We haven't actually received any of that data, but if at the end of the day we end up displaying some of you disagree, we need to take that attention.
Really interested in your second bottom there, sub-bullet. 10 years ago, before we created the GI strategy for Scotland, a small subgroup of the AGI created a strap line called the Spaces, Places and Faces of Scotland. Spaces being traditional GI, faces being address based and so on, and places being historical gazetteer type stuff. The GI techies at that time hated this because they thought that, you know, everybody knows what GIS is, which was actually about the spaces.
Yeah.
We got them to accept that the address-based data, the faces of Scotland, were something that was legitimate. But we never really got them to accept that the places were important. And as a result, the whole gazetteer-type thing, the fuzzy boundary of a place, like Mount Florida and Glasgow, what does that mean? Because it's where people live, but it doesn't actually have a boundary and a map. It was something that was really, really difficult, and we never really got that accepted. So as a result, we've got the spaces kind of sorted out. You know, we've got the addresses, we've got the faces kind of sorted out, but we still haven't really got the places sorted out. So as a result, we're still kind of struggling. So, you know, I'm really interested in your geosemantic approach here.
Well, I've got to be careful what I say here, because I was involved in a couple of meetings to do with the Scotland's Places project. But my suggestions weren't exactly followed. And I'm afraid I look at Scotland's Places and say that system doesn't... I mean, because it doesn't actually have any concept of Glasgow, it doesn't really tell you about Glasgow. It tells you about lots of things that happen to be located within Glasgow or near to some point that somebody's decided it's Glasgow. But there's no way of filtering out... I mean, it's dominated by archaeological sites because there's so many of them. I mean, it's very important to emphasise that what's behind Vision of Britain is a system that's primarily semantic and only secondarily spatial. And that's partly, as I said, for performance reasons. We couldn't get the thing... I mean, we knew we were going to have to deal with a relatively large audience. And at the time in particular, we just couldn't get the thing to perform properly with the spatial queries. But it was also about sort of having this... I mean, I'd add that the first version of Vision of Britain... that was developed with National Lottery, frankly. And the first version was all about administrative units. It had lots of... It was all about census data. But we did some focus groups, funded by the lottery. And everyone was confused by these, and we had to have a simpler notion of place, which is why, I mean, I haven't said that much about the Vision of Britain data model, but it's a dual, I described it as a dual gazetteer, because there's two linked tables, one of places, one of units. The units are children to the to the places, and there's a names table, which is a child to both of them. And one of the consequences of that is that the places inherit all the names of the administrative units associated with them. And it's a little bit more complex, but it does seem to work in a fairly intuitive way. And it is about sort of... I've got another presentation about what's a place, which is quite murky when you start thinking about and particularly, to me, the most interesting places are the areas within towns. They don't have much relationship with administrative geography. Geonames is terrible for them, I mentioned that. Wikimedia is actually much better. One of my favourite places is Nag's Head. In London, quite a lot of the places are actually the names of old villages. But a lot of the rest are the names of pubs. Elephant and Castle being very well known. Nag's Head is interesting because the pub actually closed about 20, 30 years ago. But it still exists as a place. It's on the bus timetables. Last time I checked anyway, Islington Council had the post of Nag's Head Town Centre Manager. The pub is an amusement arcade. It's a geographical feature, it's long gone. But as a place that people refer to, it's still there, it's still called Nags. It's part of the Holloway Road. It's where a lot of the shops on the Holloway Road, sort of, that's Nags Head, basically. But capturing those is hard. And, there was a meeting, how many years ago was it? Longer ago. That Bruce organised at the Royal Commission. And there were people there, one person anyway from the OS, But, I mean, one of the problems, when the AIS started, they employed lots of people to walk around the country, carrying, they were surveying, but also they talked to people. Surveying's got worse at gathering placenames. A few years back, the OS did have a very small project to try to gather place names through ethnographic research, essentially, in Southampton, one aspect of it being small. They interviewed school kids, primary school kids, policemen, and they would have interviewed the local people in the local history society, except it didn't meet in the period the project was running for, which kind of tells it was a very, 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 very small project. But it was trying to go back to the idea of capturing, you know, what names people really use. And I think for parts of town, there's a real problem. About a year ago, I found myself involved in two 999 calls. One of them was a juror listing a recording of somebody bringing the 999 because their friend was being mugged at the time within a few feet of them. And the operator kept asking, what street are you in? And the guy kept saying, I'm outside Catford Town Hall. But the other I was involved in, I was only able to get an ambulance to come by dictating the exact six-digit grid reference, including the letter codes, because they kept denying there was a place called Cobham in Kent and kept insisting I was in Surrey. There's a real, I mean, that was the issue of emergency service gazetteers was specifically referenced by the AIS as part of the justification for doing this. But no, I think trying to define places is really something that's sort of got lost somewhere.
The Narek sense is interesting because many people associate it with Peckham. But Narek. Bruce, I think you've got a question.
Yeah, thanks, Abby. That was really, really interesting. You know, as someone who spent many years creating what is essentially a geospatial gazetteer with a little bit of semantics, but not very much, actually, you know, I'm convinced. Especially in terms of historical domain, where I think you do need the semantic. The problem, of course, is that it's very easy to create a geospatial gazetteer. It's much more difficult to create a semantic gazetteer, which kind of leads me on to my question, I guess, which is in this difference between a sort of monolithic gazetteer and a federated gazetteer. You were kind of pretty clearly coming down on the monolithic side while giving some credence to the other. I'm very much on the federated simply because I don't believe you can create and keep up to date a monolithic gazetteer because you've got to continually add stuff. So I think we should probably use the library model, assuming that everybody's grown up to date, and then the best result is the combination. Of course, that's very difficult to arrange.
Yeah. Combination. I mean, it's partly this in the specific concept of plagiarism because it's agreed that all gazetteers in the Federalist Federation will use Wikidata. It's also agreed that they will make all their annotations available under a Creative Commons must acknowledge but otherwise free license. Those two conditions together make it extremely stressful to consolidate the country. And what there are two, one is I think in terms of serving people like the family history audience, people want a gazetteer. They want a front end they can access. And I think again, I mean, performance can get pretty horrid in federated systems. I think it's a lot to be said for simply harvesting all those dumps and putting them onto one system, or on lots of systems, because, I mean, it's not that I'm the only person who can do this. My dumps are going to be harvestable by other people. The other thing is something I haven't spoken about, is that, in a way, the project we really, really want to do is to expand this gazetteer massively, in a sense on the same model as Pelagius, i.e. harvesting the names that appear in old maps, but with somewhat less old maps and through genuine crowdsourcing. Because we cannot afford to find retired map curators. I mean, you can do that if you're limiting yourself to only maps produced before 1492, there's so few of them. But what we want to do is a big project on lots of maps. And we have metadata on 140,000 historical maps in the Old Maps Online project. And all of my motivation for doing the Old Maps Online project was to create that collection of old maps that we can do a crowdsourcing project on. And for that, you need a really big crowd. And you need some coherent, I mean, having a whole federation, you know, how do you actually use this federation of gazetteers? How do ordinary people access it? There needs to be some kind of communal front end. doesn't have to be any one, but there needs to be something, you know, just it's all just semantic web, and if you send the right bits of XML, you get some other RDF back. That's useful for some people, but most of the human race you might be talking about.
But I still find it remarkable that in this country, whether you're talking Scotland or the UK, we still don't have a definitive gazetteer service. Cameron, when he was in the Scottish Government, paid for me to create the data, but it's still not being served. We're at the risk of reinventing the wheel multiple times. In many ways, you've actually got the historical site more organised than we've got the contemporary site. So, and from that point of view, I don't care whether it's federated or monolithic, I just wanted to be there.
Yeah.
Can I ask
you
about your RDF?
Right, I'll do my best. I'm not an expert on this.
Okay, fine. So there are a couple of things. One of them is that what you're likely to have are a whole number of places that are the same as different areas you've already talked about.
Yeah.
Okay. So at the moment you're not sort that out, you're relying on string matching because you're using string less rules. Whereas if, for example, you use discuss itself, where using an entity for the actual preferred label, then that would enable you to have a much better approach towards crosswalking between different terms, different locations that use the same label.
We're not using names to identify places.
No, but you have them. You have them.
If we went back to that diagram.
I didn't tell you that time.
Yeah, the places are all identified by numbers.
Yeah.
They then have a series of names associated with them.
I know that.
Yeah.
Sorry. But my point is that if you then want to start taking a look at all the entities that have got a preferred label X, for example, you rely on string matching rather than on just pulling out an entity for that label X, which is extension of SCOS, which is SCOS XL. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that the librarian world, you've got vocabularies like RDA, firmware, and things like that, which are well defined towards describing the particular manifestation of a particular document resource. I didn't notice anything like that in terms of the ways in which you were referring to your resources. So it might be one of the ways in which you can build it with a bit of future proofing towards librarian world halfway by incorporating that. And the final thing is that I wonder whether or not you have any particular opportunity to look at things like the authority files that there are around or other things within the librarian world that would enable you, for example, with some of the particular authors or other cartographers or whatever, that perhaps there are already references to them in authority files where you could have a direct mapping of areas and read across towards additional data. There's the benefits of the data so far just within the domain, but it's the ability to cross domains unambiguously and build a consistent model.
Yeah. I think on the having identifiers for the name, unique identifiers for the names themselves, it's not something we've done.
Right, if you want to talk about it later, you know,
yeah.
I'm not putting on the spot here. What I'm suggesting is there are other things here that we might do at this early stage to make sure that it's a future proof of memory and that it might be worthwhile discussing these with people in these other domains in order to make sure that you're best placed to get your pitch right.
In terms of existing, I mean, in terms of referring to existing authorities, the core of the British content is the work we did on the British program. That was funded by the National Lottery. It was very much work in association with the National Council on Archives and with the National Archives at Kew. We've built, it's built, I mean, to the best of my knowledge, there's nothing in the library sector which really identifies a set of master geographical name authorities for Britain. There is in the archive sector, we built it around that. There is a problem, incidentally, that we've actually had to exclude the names taken from the main sources in that dump, because although we have the copyright to publish them, we don't have the right, in our own website, we don't have the right to put them out under a Creative Commons license. Now, that's not because they belong to commercial companies. They belong to the Royal Historical Society, the University of Wales Board on Celtic Studies, some of it belongs to the British Library. In fact, we did hold pretty much the whole scan gazetteer, which was developed by the Scottish Archives Network. We had to drop a lot of that because of copyright issues.
It's a shame about that, because there are ways in which what you can do is to provide filters for what gets put out publicly and what you use privately from the journal store.
Yeah.
So, if you do the work, there are areas where you can make it visible and other areas where you can't keep it.
Yeah. I think some of the problems here are probably to be as much legal as technical, that we're an academic project, we don't have access to a lawyer. And that was a real problem with the National Lottery funding. We were actually supposed to get all sorts of copyright clearances, but we were also banned from spending lottery money on lawyers, which meant in practice it was mostly it didn't happen. That was some years ago. And nobody at the lottery area, we signed a contract saying the copyright clearances would be sorted out, but nobody ever actually checked it happened, so it didn't. Because as project director, I had no money I could use for it.
So one final question for Angus.
There was a maybe following from Bruce's question, it's probably a slightly naive question, because I'm not a programmer, I'm not a programmer, but you did mention you're talking about using the Wikidata. You want to be able to feed back in rather than just create another silo. You want to be able to sort of feed errors or new discoveries and stuff like that back in. Could you expand on that a bit?
Well,
is that really going to happen? I know Bruce was, I remember several years ago Bruce was griping about the fact that Wikipedia nicked all these stuff from the Gazetteer of Scotland to create, to start somewhere and create their pages on. And so all these things kind of feeding off each other just by creating a dump and then building the little silo there, and it's like chicken and egg, what comes first, and to the lay user or whatever, or also the good detailed professional or academic user who are kind of starting at the same place, basically. But stop there.
There are two answers to that. One is that, remember I said that the gazetteer is not that interesting. It's the annotation. It's the annotations is really what's being created. Certainly, what Pelagius is about is creating these annotations, because they will all contain Wikidata IDs. This is extremely easy to feed that back into the Wikidata data structure. We're just putting it out there. It'll be under. Something I did on Wednesday is we shifted the whole of our scanned map library to a Creative Commons Must Acknowledge license, with the exception of the Land Utilisation Survey of Great Britain maps, and that's because those are still under the original copyright. And a lot of my reasons for doing that, well, firstly, we weren't actually making any money, so why we were being restricted. But the other was, I wanted my own students to be able to put the stuff in Wikipedia. And, because I'm running that course, I'm now very conscious there are things you can, which really are open and free, that you can put into Wikipedia. There's lots of other stuff that's not commercial, and it's certainly, it's all sitting on the web, completely open access, but you read the thing carefully, and you cannot, in fact, put it into Wikipedia. And that, to me, has become actually a bit of a goal. But it's got to be under Creative Commons Must Acknowledge, or totally public domain, which is really the same thing, except without the acknowledgement requirement. We're putting it out there in a form which means it can be fed back into Wikipedia very easily, and all sorts of other things. The other answer is that, one of the things that worries me about a lot of projects that's general nature is they're working with crowdsourced junk. And I get the impression a lot of the people who develop these systems don't actually look at the data quality. I spent quite a bit of the last 2 months staring at, a lot of the time I look at heritage. there is a lot of junk in there. And I mean, one of the things I want to discuss when we have a meeting with the Wikidata project is how can we actually feed those sort of quality issues back. I've discovered there's a small town in South Carolina with a population in order of magnitude greater than that of planet Earth. If you're ranking places by population size, that has some very bizarre consequences. And I mean, one of the things is, I said that in terms of defining the places that exist today, I think crowdsourcing is the most appropriate way of doing it. If you're talking about historical administrative geographies, I think something very different indeed. And I mean, as I said, an awful lot of academic historians, never mind family historians, are completely clueless about things like the English county system. So you do want to have more control. And it's quite clear that the Wikidata project is creating a framework within much greater consistency and fact-checking can be achieved in Wikipedia. But I think there's a whole bunch of issues about, in something which is very, very decentralised, very democratic in a certain, not entirely positive sense, how you actually start imposing a more rigid structure. But I mean, it's quite clear, Wikidata has already started to change Wikipedia, there's a few things we can point to. But how far they're willing to go on that is, I think, a really interesting question.
So I think that's an interesting acid test. You want about these wars in Birmingham 1961, which is not exactly that long ago, and it's when the recent art, when things go into recent archive, can you still find them? When I worked at our local government, I was the Department of Civil Liaison Officer, and you always got the new CDs, and you just plugged them into your system, and that overwrote the stuff that was there. And you're always working with latest, so. You know, 6 months ago, or 2 years ago, or something like that, that was historic data.
Yeah.
And you couldn't access it, you didn't have it on your desktop with a GIS system, not a historic, but a latest GIS system, not a historic GIS system. So it's like, stuff from 2001, can we find that as easily as you can from 2001?
So in relatively recent stuff can be really difficult. And another problem is that there's a lot of stuff that's effectively, nobody's interested about it, it's still in copyright. And that limits what anyone else can do with it. In fact, an odd consequence of the work we did for the European Union last year is we managed to get, when they put the 2001 and 2011 census under the Open Government License, they'd forgotten to include 1971, 81 and 91. I can claim to have got that sorted. Because it turned out we couldn't actually do the work for the EU, because we were correctly trying to derive work from that census data. And I ended up talking to the director of the census about it, and they said, that's a bit of a problem. But I mean, I do think one of the arguments for opening data is to ensure its preservation. If you don't open data, then once it gets more than 20 years old, it goes into a limbo. After 50 years, if it's survived, it'll be opened up, if it's public data, it will be opened up. But if it's seen as sort of something managed commercially, after 20 years, the commercial people totally lose interest, but nobody else can do anything.
I wonder if there's a presumption to publish, and then somebody can come and clobber you later and request. I guess it's then out in the open, so that doesn't work. Yes, great problems and things to think about. I think we'll probably let you off the hook there. What can I announce? I should say thank you to all for coming. Thank you to helpers who came and found that I'd shifted things. So, final talk of the series is in a month's time. And we'll be home here from Shire, and we're looking at the cultural ecosystem services of landscapes in Wales and all things, which hopefully involves some nice landscapes there. So thanks once again. It just remains to say thanks indeed to Humphrey for a very interesting talk. Thank you.